Hello again. After a little summer break, we're back with the Think Christian podcast. There's no such thing as secular, even in popular culture. I'm Josh Larson, editor of thinkchristian.net, your host, fresh off vacation. It was a good family trip to California, but it's also good to be back here in Chicago and doing the podcast. This should be an exciting show because we get to talk about someone who I would call a patron saint of Think Christian in a way, an artist who has made that sacred slash secular distinction pretty much irrelevant over the course of her career. I'm talking about the legendary Mavis Staples. Eric Danielson and I will talk about Mavis's latest album, We Get By, another collaborative work for her, this time with Ben Harper, that captures what it means to create in community. Now, community is also a hallmark of the Toy Story series of films as well. Think about the Fellowship of the Playroom. So first on the show, Abby Olchesi and I are going to pick up on that theme as it relates to Toy Story 4. A quick note here to thank those of you who have left a rating or a review for the TC Podcast on Apple Podcasts. Please do keep those coming if you haven't had a chance to do it yet. And please do enjoy my conversation with Abby Olchesi about Woody, Buzz, and the rest of the toys. A fellowship that even makes room for a strange little spork man named Forky. I'm here with Abby Olchesi. And Abby, I've been arguing with people for the last couple of weeks now about the ending of Toy Story 4. I wasn't a fan myself, liked the movie overall, just didn't really go for where they went in those final moments. I have a feeling that you and I, are we going to disagree on that a little bit too? From what I've seen of your writing about Toy Story 4, I think we might.
Yeah, I think we may not be on quite the same page, but I'm very interested to hear what your take on it was, since I know what mine is.
We'll get to that a little later. I want to do some non-spoiler stuff here at the top, especially for those people who haven't seen Toy Story 4 yet. This is, of course, the latest installment, and here we have Woody, Buzz, and the gang off on another adventure. It's a family vacation, essentially. So they're off in an RV with their new owner, little Bonnie, and they've got a new friend, Forky. Now, Abby, maybe you can describe Forky for us. This is, to me, one of the most charming slash terrifying characters that we've gotten in the movies in a long time. Would you care to do the honors of telling people about Forky?
Absolutely. So Forky is a toy that Bonnie creates at her kindergarten orientation day when she is feeling lonely and in need of a friend. So she creates Forky from a spork with a pair of mismatched googly eyes, pipe cleaners for arms, and she draws on a pair of eyebrows and a weird little mouth, and he's got popsicle sticks for feet that are attached with kind of a Play-Doh putty situation. So his walking is not great so much as it is just kind of waddling.
Yes, yes. And those eyes, I'm glad you mentioned the eyes. The fact that they're mismatched is so disorienting. They're kind of like looking multiple. I mean, googly eyes are always looking multiple directions at once, but this just enhances that. And the animation here, some of the details you talked about, the walking, of course, Pixar is going to be great at this sort of thing, but I love how he does move, and it captures what would be the awkwardness of, you know, being a hodgepodge kindergarten craft, but also captures the intentionality of a sentient being, you know, someone or something who's trying to walk or learning to walk. And that's kind of the essential quality of Forky, is this creature trying to figure out why he exists and what this new life for him means. I got an email from TC contributor Jonathan Kana about Forky, and I wanted to share a little bit of that here and then get your take on this, Abby. So he was talking about the way Forky describes himself as trash, being made of trash, and he continually tries to seek refuge in garbage cans in the movie. And Jonathan wrote that this is, quote, a gospel concept that Woody gets even when the other toys struggle to get on board. For Woody, Forky has value because he is made in Bonnie's image, in a sense. He sees how Forky is just as important as any other toy because Bonnie has imbued him with life and purpose, not unlike the way God does for any of us. What makes him a toy and not trash is the fact that Bonnie's name is written across the bottom of his feet. And of course, that is a motif we've seen throughout this series, this idea of claiming by writing one's name on the bottom of a toy's feet. Does any of that resonate with your experience of Forky, Abby?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's interesting that it feels like when Bonnie is making Forky, that the thing that brings him to life is the fact that she writes her name on the bottom of his feet, that like he is hers and he is her toy. Mm-hmm. He's not created as just like a lump of objects that she's put together. She has put intentionality into him as soon as she writes her name on him, which is, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah, and it does get to this idea of purpose, I think. And because of this, because of Forky's value here as a created being, I think that's largely why Woody brings him into the fold and saves him from this lonely dead end of the garbage can. And I think this is also one of the ways that Toy Story 4, and really like all the other films, captures a sense of community, how it creates, in a sense, this fellowship of believers it can be described as. And here's where I want to bring in Acts 2 and think about the way the early church, that fellowship of believers, was described. Acts 2 says, all the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. So I read that, and I think not only of Woody introducing the rest of the playroom to Forky when he gets back from that first day of kindergarten orientation, but also the many scenes in this series of groups of toys gathered together. For me, that's one of the first images that comes to mind when I think of the Toy Story films, is this gathering of toys in some sort of communal space, being there, supporting each other, sustaining that sort of community. I think it's also, you know, a lot of the action scenes that this series has, it's another one of the defining elements are the action scenes. They revolve around gathering in the lost in some way. That's the ultimate goal. So they seem to be a recurring motif in this series, this idea of this community, this fellowship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I hadn't thought about the very end of the passage that you read where the Lord added daily to their number those who were being saved. It's something that I've thought about actually separately in the Toy Story films, that oftentimes by the end of it, either Andy or Bonnie, whoever their owner happens to be at the time, has gained a significantly larger number of toys without actually doing anything. Like they weren't given to them, they were found and brought in.
Yeah.
And so somehow they're just sort of mysteriously these new toys that are just sort of showing up in their room, but they're no less beloved and they're always used and they're always welcome. So I think that's a great parallel.
Yeah, the welcoming bit. I do like that. And you're right, the numbers increase. Although over the films, I think we've also lost a few here or there. That's a reality that the series makes room for as well. And I think that probably does bring us a little closer to the ending where we can talk about that, the ending of Toy Story 4. We will get into spoilers here. So again, if you haven't seen the film yet, maybe just jump ahead a few minutes here in the episode. If you start hearing some music, you'll know it's safe. But we're going to spend just a couple of minutes on the end of Toy Story 4 and what it means for this community maybe that we've known and what it might mean for a new community that the movie suggests. Abby, maybe you can recap briefly what does happen at the end, specifically around Woody's decision, and then share what you liked about it.
Sure. So toward the end of the film, up to this point, the goal for Woody has been to rescue Forky, who has tried to escape the vacation so that he can throw himself in the trash. And through his journey, he is reunited with Bo Peep, who was a friend of his from Andy's house, who has ended up in an antique shop and has decided that she is her own toy. She's independent. She's not going to be owned by anybody. So his ultimate goal is to get back to Bonnie and to get Forky back to Bonnie. But in the course of his journey, he is equally interested in Bo Peep's lifestyle, which is not something that he had expected to be interested in. And so by the end of the film, he comes to a decision point. He can either go back with the rest of the toys into the RV and rejoin Bonnie, or he can go with Bo Peep and the other friends that he has made in kind of the Lost Toy Collective and try and go after a new life with a more independent sort of self-ownership of that lifestyle, but also with a certain amount of uncertainty. He doesn't know where he's going to end up if he goes that way. And he ultimately chooses to go with Bo Peep. And so the rest of the film, there's a couple of stingers after the credits that show Woody and his new friends following this carnival that they've been kind of hanging around in and helping the prize toys to find proper homes, to find new owners.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's still definitely in those post-credit scenes, the idea of Woody helping Toys find a new place. We definitely get that. But the decision to go with Bo Peep, she does end up in the antique store, but then escapes from there or leaves there somehow and is really living just outside on her own. She rides around, I love this touch, on like a remote control car that's disguised as a skunk so she can go anywhere she wants and people don't bother her. So yeah, that's what's distinct for me. That was like a real swerve for Woody to choose to have that life on the road, essentially, that life of uncertainty. So why did it work for you?
I liked it. It probably helps to put this in a little bit of context. I've been taking an Enneagram class through my church.
Okay.
I believe Woody is a two, that it's important for him to be useful and it's important for him to be helpful to people. And one of the things that came up in a panel discussion, this was for a different type, but something that I thought applied very well to Woody in this particular situation, was somebody who said that she had been spending so much of her life pouring herself into the needs of her kids and her family that when everybody left the house and that she was an empty nester, she didn't know what to do with herself. And this was a time that she had to sort of reflect, like, who am I? What is my purpose? What am I doing? And I think Toy Story 4 is very much about Woody being in that same position. He's not fitting in as well with the other toys at Bonnie's. He's being sat in the closet, not being played with, and he feels unuseful, which as a two is one of his greatest fears. So I think he comes through the course of the movie to recognize that he needs to redefine who he is now in this new situation, and perhaps for his own health, as well as the health of the community that he is trying to foster along, it might be better if he went his own way and tried something different, which I think is an important thing for individuals and for communities of faith to recognize that sometimes you're going to grow, sometimes you're going to shrink, and sometimes you have to adapt to a new role within a community, and sometimes you have to be willing to redefine yourself by going elsewhere as circumstances change.
So the Enneagram theory, I love that. I wish I was more familiar. I did that once, didn't take the test, or I don't know what you do, filled out the forms, whatever, waiting for a plane once in an airport. That's about my familiarity. So your description of Woody that way certainly sounds correct to me. I think that's pretty accurate. For me, it was, I don't think he was quite as unhappy in his current status as maybe the movie wanted him to be to make this move. I really see him out there on the road and regretting it in a month or two because he's almost swung way too far the other direction. Certainly the movie, you know, it does point out that he's not being played with as much. He's maybe not the sheriff of this playroom anymore, but I still think his place and purpose is being part of community. And the way they describe the existence with Bo Peep, it's more romantic too. I read it more as romantic and sort of this square way of, okay, let's pair Woody off with a woman and they almost have their kids with the three little sheep and,
right.
And they're nicely now together. So he can be off on his own. And I just like the vision of Woody always being instead this communal member who maybe he's the leader and maybe that's the stepping back. Like there's a middle ground between what I'm seeing and what you're describing. He doesn't necessarily, in my mind, always have to be the leader, always have to be in charge. I do like the idea of retirement that you're talking about or just, you know, being an empty nester. I think that makes a lot of sense, but maybe there was a place for me for Woody to do that within the playroom still. Because this just seems like a really drastic leap for him to be out there as a lost toy. I just don't think he was ever meant to be a lost toy.
That's fair. I've thought about, like, if Pixar were really to want to do further movies in the series, which I kind of hope they don't. I think this is sort of a nice way for it to end. But then I said that about three and look where we got.
Yeah.
So I do think it's possible that there could be space for conflict in that sphere in the future where he is out on the road doing his thing and then starts to recognize how happy those kids are with the toys that they get and think, man, I miss that. I want to be part of that community again.
Yeah, that's it. Part of it is for him to completely set aside the relationship with a kid. That relationship, again, might change. He might have to learn to not be the favorite toy. But for this ending to completely set aside that part of who Woody is, for me, is what seems really drastic, is that he's not going to find that on the road. He can still build these mini communities, temporary communities. He can connect other toys with kids. But I think that's really a part of who he is to have that relationship. So yeah, maybe Toy Story 5, like, Woody and Bo bickering. It'll be kind of nasty and the most grown-up Toy Story yet. I don't know if I want to see that, though.
I think the catalyst will be that Ducky and Bunny and Duke Kaboom, like, find a family, and Woody thinks, oh, man, I think maybe I want to hang out with them instead.
I can see that. Yeah, Duke Kaboom, all three of those really great new characters, along with Gabby Gabby, who is sort of the villain in this film that we didn't get to. So there is, as I said, a lot of good stuff here. I'm with you. I didn't need a Toy Story 4. I think Toy Story 3 actually ended better for me, but they did prove to me that there was reason to make another one. Forky alone, for me, was reason to make another one. So Abby has more on Toy Story 4 on the TC website, getting into some of those things you were just talking about, Abby, in terms of new roles and embracing that in a community of faith. So if you want to check that out, head over to thinkchristian.net and you can find that story. Thanks for putting up with my Toy Story 4 grumpiness there about the ending, Abby. I appreciate it.
No problem at all. I thought it was a good conversation and a dialogue worth having.
All right, good. We'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks. We are family. Ooh, I got all my brothers and my sisters with me.
Sometimes you just need the redemptive power of Pat Boone to rescue a song from the clutches of overexposure and bad wedding bands. Hello all, this is your resident Think Christian DJ John J. Thompson, and that was a version of We Are Family that I suspect most of you haven't heard before. That was indeed Pat Boone, backed by the original artist Sister Sledge, tapping into the latent and I think very fun schmaltzy undertones of We Are Family. In doing so, I hope that it helped set the mood, along with 24 other songs, for this conversation about the fellowship of believers. This was a particularly fun playlist to pull together for me, mostly because music has always been one of the ways I feel connected to people. When I was a kid, I would listen to certain songs and feel like I was getting a peek into a different world, one in which things actually made sense. I felt like certain songwriters and artists were my friends. Then when I got to actually experience live music as a member of an audience, especially at something like a festival, the music really helped pull me out of myself and into community or fellowship with others. I sure hope you enjoy this batch of songs. It's a wild one, with entries from Mavis Staples, who Eric and Josh will be talking about here in just a moment, as well as a brand new track from Drew Holcomb and The Neighbors, a super oldie from The Hollies, stuff from Depeche Mode, Sly and the Family Stone, Judah and the Lion, Fall Out Boy, Vampire Weekend, Ryan Adams, and a great tune from B.B. King and Irma Thomas called We're Gonna Make It that you'll hear a little bit later in this episode. There's even a Muppets classic I just could not resist, and a whole lot more. To listen along, just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify and hit play. If you follow the latest episode playlist, you'll always have the newest one there in your browser, but you can also find each episode's playlist listed separately under the Think Christian profile. Plus, we'll combine all of the playlists into one massive archive so you can follow that as well. And as always, if you think of any great songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me, at John J. Thompson, and I'll see what I can do. That's it for now, but until next time, remember, when the music's playing, everyone's family, so turn it up.
Let's bring on Eric Danielson. We had to get one of our music experts to consider someone who's really a musical legend, Mavis Staples. Eric, when and how did Mavis first become a part of your life soundtrack? When did you start listening to her?
Well, so there's the cool answer, and then there's the embarrassing answer. The embarrassing answer is that I didn't realize that I had been listening to her for a long time in the form of the theme song to National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, which she delivered in kind of more of a fallow period in her career in the 80s. So I had been hearing Mavis Staples growing up before I even knew it. But of course, as I got older and became more well-versed in music, I started kind of listening to a little bit of her work with the band and of course with her family, and then really dived in earnest back around 2010 when she started making records with Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, one of my favorite artists. And you know, one of those people that kind of anything he touches, I'll pay attention to. And so that spurred me to hear her kind of in the present tense, but then obviously to go back and sift through her back catalog.
Sure. Yeah, similar story here. And I just learned that I was listening to her earlier than I thought with that Vacation movie, because I would have known that song as well. But yeah, for me, it wasn't until 2010 with You Are Not Alone, the Tweedy produced album you mentioned, that I really got into her. Certainly, I was aware of her stature, you know, and you mentioned that she was singing with her family's band, the Staple Singers, in the 60s. So knew all that, but it wasn't until 2010 that I really began following her work closely. And in a way, it was, sounds crazy to say, a time to jump on board because she already had such an accomplished career, but it was kind of a nice time to do that because it kicked off this season of collaboration for Staples that is really still taking place with her most recent release, We Get By. Eric, maybe you can quickly walk us through what Staples, who turns 80 on July 10, we should note, what she's been up to in recent years since that 2010 album.
Yeah. So, I mean, this has been a really productive decade for her. I had forgotten when I wrote about her for TC that she had done an album in 2007 produced by Ry Cooder. So that maybe really is kind of the initial spark for this decade. But she's made 5 records in the 2010s, which is, I mean, really as prolific as just about any artist is these days. And she's made 3 of them with Jeff Tweedy, 1 record kind of sandwiched in between those with M. Ward, the, in my mind, really underrated singer-songwriter. A lot of people know him for working in She and Him with Zooey Deschanel. And then, of course, yeah, We Get By with Ben Harper. And so there's been this really cool period where she's really spent a lot of time working with these artists that they're established in their own right. I mean, these are guys who all of them have been around for decades, but you know, by virtue of the fact that she's 80, all of these guys are a good 30 or 40 years younger than she is.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of been this cool cross-generational thing that she's really seemed to thrive on over the last decade or so.
Is there something you can point to, you know, musically that these collaborations have brought out for her? I don't think anyone's claimed that she significantly changed her sound or even really what she wants to sing about or be as a musician. But is there something you can point to and say, having worked this way for the last 10 plus years, that it's kind of brought out in her music or shifted her music a little bit?
Yeah, I don't know, like you said, that there's been any big shifts. I think the thing that stands out most to me is just that all of these producers seem to really have an understanding of her voice. And in their own music have kind of touched on some of those same musical elements in new and fresh ways. And so to me, what it is that a lot of times these legacy artists kind of get, you know, in the habit or in a rut of working with the same people they've worked with their whole careers. And so it kind of just sounds like the same old thing over and over again. And what happens on these newer Staples records, she sounds like herself. She doesn't sound like anybody else, but it just sounds like there's just a real vibrancy there, you know, that she sounds inspired by kind of just the freshness of those collaborations. And so it's really just a really lovely kind of, like I said, present tense application of what she's been doing for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And collaboration like that, it requires community. It requires fellowship. When it comes to Mavis, I think it's pretty easy to make a connection between her work and this biblical idea of a fellowship of believers. I mean, she's long made her Christian faith a crucial and integral part of her songs. It's right there at the forefront of so many of them and right there in the lyrics. So this notion of gathering together as a people of faith in times of need, in acts of praise, to add in number, that's a clear theme throughout this most recent phase of her career. We can point to a couple of things, I think. It's right there in the title of that 2010 album, You Are Not Alone. I hear it in Take Us Back from 2016's Living on a High Note, where she sings, I got help from all the people who love me. And then there's the title track from her new album, We Get By. Let's take a listen to that.
Day by day, line by line, if you don't have yours, you sure got mine.
We get by day by day. We get by in our own way.
We get by. We get by. No matter how it happens, I'll be there for you. We get by.
So that's Ben Harper there, who did, as you mentioned, produce the album, appearing on the song. And first off, I can't imagine another voice blending so beautifully with Mavis's. I think that the idea of having a duet, which I don't know if she did with any of the other artist producers she worked with. Maybe here or there, does one come to mind off the top of your head, Eric?
Not off the top of my head. I think maybe seen some live stuff with Jeff Tweedy where they may have traded vocals a little bit more. But I think in most of those cases that those artists maybe lended some harmony vocals, but nothing so prominent.
Yeah, that sounds right to me too. So this full force duet here, it's perfect for this notion of community and fellowship. It takes more than one, right? We actually literally hear that there. And there's also this line in We Get By, if you don't have yours, you sure got mine, which reminds me of the early church in Acts, sharing in everything and providing for those in need. What'd you think of that song, of We Get By, Eric? And then maybe you can mention another one that you think we should highlight from the album.
Sure. Yeah, no, I really like the duet. I mean, I think you're right. It really is a great marriage of medium and message. And there's a line that, as I've kind of revisited the record, that hits me right there at the beginning. She says something to the effect of, we get by with a smile on our face. Maybe that was just a meter choice, you know, but she doesn't say faces, she says face. And there's kind of this cool thing again of just like, we're all in this together. And you're right. I think just the way that she and Ben Harper trade vocals and then layer their vocals, it only underlines what they're trying to say there. I mean, that song is great. I really like the next song on the record, Brothers and Sisters, which again, there's kind of a call and response gospel feel to it that is not uncommon throughout what she's done, but there's just kind of this series of exhortations that she delivers throughout that song. And then the last one is kind of my favorite. And I'll just read the lyrics here briefly. She says, "We've come too far to be lost, brothers and sisters. So many bridges yet to cross, brothers and sisters. I'm waiting on you like a message from God, brothers and sisters." And I just really like that line. It reminds me, there's a Dietrich Bonhoeffer quote that I always go back to, where he talks about the idea that, you know, the Christ in our hearts is weak, but the Christ in our brothers' words is strong. And so when we hear someone else share the gospel, it kind of boosts or kind of buoys up the gospel that's in our own hearts. And it's kind of cool in that song. I feel like Mavis does both. At first, she is the Christ in those words, kind of encouraging her brothers and sisters. But then she goes on to say, you know, I'm waiting on you like a message from God. I need to hear from you too, if I'm going to keep going and persevere in my faith. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of cool little moments like that throughout the record where she's exhorting folks, but then she also admits, I need you just as much. I'm relying on you too. So I really like that.
Yeah, let's play a little bit of that.
We've come too far to be lost. Brothers and sisters, so many bridges, yet, oh, yet to cross. Brothers and sisters, I'm waiting on you like a message from God. Brothers and sisters, something's got to give.
There's sort of a challenge and a request going on, a back and forth in that song, I think. And that's part of fellowship, of Christian fellowship, is to carry the load of faith for someone else when they're faltering, and then they can carry it for you. When you think of it as a club, one reason that doesn't work is it's not that you have the right answer, you have the right credentials, you get into the club where everything is fine. Instead, it's that we do hold the truth and we hold that together, but we also know that the journey is not going to be an easy one. And so that's where fellowship is more of an appropriate term, I think, where we do hold each other up, be there when one of us falters, and then we can be there for someone else when they're struggling. So yeah, I think that song does capture that notion really well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really prevalent throughout her work, and you would probably say the gospel tradition in general, is she talks a lot about social change being something we do together. It's a community project, but she doesn't then pivot ever and say, well, my faith is just mine. She sees sanctification and faith and perseverance and all of those things as community projects too, that they can't happen independently. And so, yeah, that fellowship really is required, that I'm going to give as much as I have to you, but if I don't have you giving back to me, I'm going to fall down. I'm going to falter at some point. So there's just, yeah, always kind of this really beautiful exchange present there in the words and in the music.
Faith as a personal thing, but also a social and communal thing as well. Sure. Yeah, that's a hallmark of her music. Well, as you mentioned, Eric, on the TC website, you do write a little bit about these recent albums as intergenerational collaborations. You bring in how it echoes what Paul writes about in 1 Timothy and Titus. So I'd encourage listeners to check that out and get to consider a little bit more about what Mavis Staples has been up to with these recent albums. So thanks so much, Eric, for writing that and for jumping on the podcast to talk about it.
Yeah, my pleasure for sure.
We may have to fight hardships alone.
There aren't too many artists who could follow Mavis Staples. The late B.B. King, who you heard there with New Orleans soul legend Irma Thomas, is probably one of them. You can hear all of their duet, We're Gonna Make It, on John J. Thompson's Spotify playlist that he put together to accompany this episode. Of course, he also has a little bit more from Mavis's album, We Get By, on that playlist. Whatever you do, listen to a little Mavis today. I guarantee you'll be encouraged as part of the Fellowship of Believers. Thanks to John for compiling that playlist. You can find it by searching for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. Thank you also to Eric Danielson and Abby Olchesi. Check out those articles we mentioned that they wrote over at thinkchristian.net. And if you want to keep up on all the stuff we're publishing at the website, you can sign up to receive our emails at thinkchristian.net/subscribe. If you have any thoughts about the show, please do let me know. I'm Josh Larson. Very easy to reach me, jlarson@reframemedia.com. That's J-L-A-R-S-E-N. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our executive producer is Stephen Koster, and our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder. We want to say a note of thanks as well to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois, which provided the recording space for this episode. Learn more at trnty.edu. And go Trolls.